Planned layoffs shot up last month,
but private employers added some jobs.
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bob Moon in for Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for downloading our podcast from marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, March 2nd. Coming up, Libyan fighting today could affect what you pay for gas tomorrow. Yahoo's pulling out of Japan to free up money for an even bigger fight.
And some big no-nos when you're looking for a job. We'll have those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update from Marketplace.org.
What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, Marketplace.org.
Private employers added 217,000 jobs in February, according to employer service firm ADP. Now, that's much higher than analysts were expecting. But another report out today says planned layoffs also shot up last month to the highest level in more than a year. That report from Challenger Gray and Christmas.
Some analysis this morning now from Richard DeKayser with the Parthenon Group, a Boston-based management consulting firm. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob.
Let's take that ADP payroll report first. 217,000 new jobs unofficially sounds good ahead of this Friday's government tally.
Well, it is good. This is about the third month that we've seen numbers around 200,000. That's the best three-month string in about 5 years. So this is the easy one. Employment seems to be rising in the private sector. Good news all overall.
Well, but what about that report from Challenger Gray and Christmas? It found the number of planned layoffs at U.S. firms rose in February to its highest level in 11 months. How do you balance those two?
Well, I think in both cases, weather is a little bit at play. So, for example, in January this year, prior to February, we had the lowest level of layoffs, according to Challenger folks, in, well, ever, since they've been putting out their numbers back in 1993. That was probably due to blizzards. Business etiquette still doesn't require, but holds for laying someone off in a face-to-face way. So workers showed up again in February, and layoffs increased as a result, but I wouldn't take that single month too desperately in isolation. I think what's going on here has been short-term influence of weather.
And as we say, the big number out Friday. Richard DeKayser with the Parthenon Group, a Boston-based management consulting firm. Thanks for your insights.
My pleasure.
The federal government is thinking of making it even harder for people to buy homes. Reports are this morning regulators may encourage banks to make fewer risky home loans, and that could encourage banks to require homeowners bring as much as 20% down to the process. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is with us from Washington with the latest. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
Why would the government want home buyers to shell out even more for a down payment?
Well, Steve, since the housing crisis, we now know that banks don't keep most of their loans. They sell them to investors. The idea of this 20% rule is to force banks to have a little skin in the game. So the feds are saying to banks, look, if you make a riskier loan like those with down payments of less than 20%, you can't sell the whole loan. But with a 20% down payment, banks could sell off the entire loan. Guy Sakala publishes Inside Mortgage Finance. I talked to him this morning, and he said the idea is to stabilize the housing market.
They're going to put some standards in place now. That'll mean a stronger housing market in 10 or 20 years, but it'll certainly mean less Americans getting homes and less Americans getting mortgages.
Yeah, I mean, fewer Americans getting mortgages. What's that going to look like?
Well, Sakala says low and even moderate income Americans could just be priced out of the housing market. There is a little bit of good news, though. Sakala says as things stabilize, banks will start to feel more comfortable making loans with a 10% down payment. But that's going to take a few years.
All right. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer. Nancy, thanks.
You're welcome.
There will be a new cop on the bank beat this summer. The Consumer Financial Product Bureau will have limited enforcement powers over small banks and credit unions. But today, the House Financial Services Committee is letting small banks air their concerns over even that partial control, as our John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
Bob Ramsey is a bank analyst with FBR Capital Markets. He says smaller banks will take a bigger hit from, say, new paperwork requirements than big competitors would.
Think about the fixed costs associated with changing the disclosures on your mortgage forms to a company the size of a Bank of America is immaterial once you spread it across thousands of customers. But if you're a small community bank, the incremental cost is certainly much more significant.
He says those extra costs could crimp bank lending, but Travis Plunkett with the Consumer Federation of America says the financial reforms give small banks special consideration.
The small banks had enormous influence on the legislative process, and they were able to get themselves excluded from the bulk of the regulatory costs.
Plunkett says the Consumer Bureau has to closely scrutinize new regulations to make sure they don't burden small banks and credit unions. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Homebuilder Hovnanian and Enterprises said it returned to a loss in its fiscal first quarter, but the CEO said he's encouraged by a recent uptick in business. Global stocks were much lower today. In Asia, the Nikkei tumbled 2.5%. All on news, the price of oil keeps going up.
In a few moments, we'll check in on how the battle for control of oil strongholds in Libya could do a number on the economy. For more numbers, stocks here in the U.S. and others, check out the numbers section at our website, marketplace.org. Listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, March 2nd. I'm Bob Moon.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. Now the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world? Oil is trading at more than $100 a barrel today. And the situation in the Middle East and North Africa keeps driving the price hike.
It's been a real battle for control of oil strongholds in Libya ever since opposition forces have tried to overthrow Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Rebel forces have taken control of a number of oil export terminals in the east near Benghazi, but government fighters are trying to retake control.
We tell you this because what happens in those places is having a big impact on the price of oil and gas. Libya, of course, is a big oil producer. Samuel Chisuk is senior analyst for consulting firm IHS Energy, and he's with us now from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we've gotten these reports that pro-government forces are attacking key oil cities in Libya. What's that going to do to the market?
It's going to continue, obviously, to rattle the market. For now, I think, you know, Libyan production is pretty much discounted. However, if we actually see fighting about upstream and downstream installations, and then, you know, obviously potential damage to them, we are starting to talk about long-term impacts.
A senior official there in Libya at the state oil company said that the country is going to continue to get paid, even if it gets hit with sanctions from around the world. How's that going to work?
Firstly, we need to take everything that comes from the upper echelons of the old regime with a big pinch of salt. But, you know, at the same time, there's no facilities for the financial transactions to take place for opposition-controlled exports. Everything is still sort of flowing into accounts held effectively by the old government. And some of this oil has already been sold on a term contract to oil companies. So if suddenly opposition forces start to sell the same oil to other ones, there might be legal problems between oil companies in the West.
Are we guaranteed, assuming that opposition forces do take the reins in Libya, that things will settle down?
No, I think unfortunately there's no guarantees at all, and this is what makes it very unpredictable.
Samuel Chisuk, senior energy analyst for IHS Energy in London. Samuel, thank you.
Thank you.
It's being billed as the greenest car show ever. The Geneva Auto Show in Switzerland even features an electric Rolls-Royce concept car. Other car makers have debuted electric and hybrid models. But a senior Ford executive says don't get carried away. There won't be an electric car craze anytime soon. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Ford's chief financial officer says don't expect a big surge in electric car sales. These vehicles are still very expensive. Even with government subsidies, they can cost double what a regular vehicle costs. And he says those subsidies must be in doubt as Western governments struggle to cut their spending. The Ford executive warns that electric cars may remain a plaything of the rich. Professor David Bailey of Coventry University agrees that we're not on the threshold of an electric revolution.
It's still coming, but it's going to be slow. And I think we'll also see very big improvements in gasoline engines, which will get their costs down as well. So consumers may well stick with that technology.
He says the brightest future for electric vehicles may be in China, where government and manufacturers are pouring billions into the new technology. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Yahoo is reportedly in talks to sell its Japanese venture, and that's going to free up about $8 billion for Yahoo to fight Google and Facebook. But Yahoo just got overtaken by Microsoft's Bing in the search engine business, according to a new survey. From Silicon Valley, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
There are lots of firms out there that try and measure traffic that flows through the world's biggest search engines. And the numbers they report tend to vary a lot.
It's a very squishy metric.
Lou Kerner's an analyst at Wedbush Securities. But Kerner says the trends here are clear. Microsoft's Bing search engine is gaining market share. Yahoo is losing it. And Google is still totally dominant. Last year, Yahoo and Bing joined forces. Yahoo stopped powering its own searches, and today Bing and Yahoo sell search ads together.
You know, Yahoo was falling further and further behind, and I think their partnership with Bing was really the best solution that they had to deal with Google.
The idea was to team up and take on the industry giant, but so far, it looks like Bing and Yahoo are just eating each other's lunch. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Some unwelcome stowaways started bugging passengers, and now British Airways has had them forcibly removed, so to speak. This after a frequent flying Yahoo executive claimed she suffered 90 bed bug bites on what turned out to be literally a bloody flight from London to L.A.
Ugh.
When it happened again on another flight, she lost patience with BA's response and created a website with graphic pictures and chose a very effective double entendre name for the site, BABites.com. Effective, I say, because BA now says it grounded and fumigated two of its 747 jumbo jets. It also apologized. Don't let the bed bugs bite for the duration of your flight, right? I don't know, though, Steve. Given the way the airline industry operates these days, I'd start checking your ticket for some kind of new charge, probably buried under something like the pest removal and mitigation recovery fee, huh?
That's the ticket. You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, the 2nd day of March. I'm Steve Chiotakis on Twitter at Radio Chio.
And I'm Bob Moon. There's a move here in California to have the state jump on the nationwide bandwagon for a new kind of sin tax. And we've got LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus in the studio to talk about it. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
So what is California proposing here?
Well, a California lawmaker, William Monning, is proposing a penny per ounce tax on sweetened beverages. You're talking soda, you're talking sports drinks, you're talking energy drinks.
Isn't this going to hit low-income people the hardest?
Well, probably, because many studies show that lower-income communities and minority communities tend to be some of the highest users of soda pop. On the other hand, if that's where the obesity crisis is biggest, perhaps that's where you need to target. And right now, what we're seeing is Black communities, Latino communities have disproportionately higher levels of obesity. And overall in America, two-thirds of U.S. adults are either overweight or obese right now. So the problem is profound.
Now, this amounts to a sin tax. Do we know how effective it's been in other states that have instituted this?
You know, it varies with that sort of thing. For example, in 2009, the New England Journal of Medicine said that these sorts of taxes are a very good way to combat the obesity crisis. On the other hand, last year, the Rand Corporation came out with a report that said soda taxes that are at their current levels of about 4% or so are not really going to do the job. People will simply pay that extra amount for their sugar fix. On the other hand, Rand found that if you had a soda tax in the 18% range or 18 cents for every dollar, that would have a big impact.
But a few pennies. Does that really discourage consumption? I mean, I'm already paying, in some cases, $5 or $6 for a 12-pack of sugar water.
All true, and you'll probably pay whatever you want if you want your fix. On the other hand, if our goal is to try and create resources that would give Americans just better opportunities to be physically fit, bike paths, basketball courts, gym memberships, well, that money has to come from somewhere. And as with all sin taxes, you're taking a negative behavior and trying to turn it into a positive.
Brace yourself, huh, if you're really into that sugar fix.
Or get up and take a walk.
David Lazarus is consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It was a Scottish deerhound, a hunting dog, which won the Westminster Dog Show a couple of weeks ago. But it's the popularity of herding dogs these days that's boosting the sheep farm economy. Did you know there's such a thing?
I didn't know that.
The sheep farm economy. Well, some farms now let dog owners rent time with sheep. So Fido can do what Fido does best. From Olympia, Washington, Ann Dornfeld reports.
Right there. Lie down. Hey.
On this chilly Saturday, half a dozen city dwellers are lined up with their dogs along a muddy field. The dogs are waiting for their turn to chase a flock of sheep into a tiny pen.
No, lie down.
Sylvia Griggs is the facilities manager at Fido's farm, an 80-acre spread with hundreds of sheep. It's been in operation for 7 years. Griggs says business is booming thanks to the growing popularity of herding dogs as pets.
A large base is mainly Australian Shepherds. People have no clue how active those dogs really are. They're not designed as a pet. The dogs are bred to work, to have a job, and they don't do well if they don't have some type of outlet.
When herding dogs don't have an opportunity to round up livestock, they devote that extra energy to nipping at your kids' heels as they ride their bikes or chewing up the house. Greta Zerker knows firsthand. She's here with her young border collie, Tess.
She destroyed some Oriental carpets, every single one. She chewed the edges. I ended up duct taping them to the floor to keep her from chewing them.
How much were those worth?
About $5,000 each.
Today, Zerker is spending $15, so Tess can spend a day with the sheep. Zerker lives in a Portland suburb, but she says the 2.5-hour drive is worth it. Zerker says as soon as she got Tess around sheep, it was clear that this dog was born to herd.
It was actually really interesting. I carried her into a packed pen, and she had them all in the corner just by looking at them. It was just impressive to me.
Zerker says Tess's behavior has improved a lot since she started herding. Sylvia Griggs says Fido's farm now gets more than a dozen customers like Zerker a day.
Basically, it's all word of mouth. You know, we do very little advertising about the herding.
Other breeds can herd, too. Standard poodles, Rottweilers, and Rhodesian Ridgebacks all have a knack for it, apparently. But if your dog doesn't have a natural herding instinct, Fido's Farm gives lessons for $35 a pop. In Olympia, Washington, I'm Ann Dornfeld for Marketplace.
And finally, you heard about those mixed signals in the job market today? Well, CareerBuilder.com says hiring folks have reported some big mistakes that they've seen during the interview process. You know, just sort of the no-nos that that some people do in the interview process. Chewing gum right during an interview, probably something you shouldn't do.
Not a good idea.
Dressing inappropriately, being too, a little too casual, right? You want to show off that good look. Well, then there are some pretty outlandish things that the website lists in its report. One applicant promised on her resume, I think this was out of Europe, that she wasn't a gypsy. She put that on her resume. I'm not a gypsy. Another on a resume labeled God as a reference.
I'd like to know his phone number,
How do you get in touch with God? I think that would be a pretty, like a very popular phone number to find.
Uh-huh.
All right. So interested in some other no-nos, we've got them at our website, marketplace.org. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
I'm Bob Moon. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.